NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. Since the founding of our republic over 200 years ago, the United States Supreme Court has endured as a central arbiter of our rights and responsibilities as a people. And currently, no individual is more critical to preserving that institution than Chief Justice John Roberts, especially as he guides the court through some of the most incendiary issues in recent memory, including gay marriage, health care, Second Amendment rights, and campaign finance reform, not to mention recent decisions on DNA collection and voter registration requirements. In her new book, veteran Washington correspondent Marcia Coyle takes us inside the Roberts Court and through several landmark 5-4 decisions in order to shed new light on the impact of politics, personality, ideology, and judicial philosophy on the Supreme Court. In doing so, Coyle also gives us a first glimpse at what may be the future legacy of the Roberts Court. Today on The Exchange, understanding the Roberts Court. Let's hear from you. What are your impressions of the Roberts Court? Which decisions or issues before the court are of greatest interest to you? Do you think the Supreme Court has become too politicized in recent years? How can the court best preserve its legitimacy as the chief interpreter of our Constitution? Call into The Exchange. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And joining me from Washington, D.C. this morning is Marcia Coyle. Marcia is chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal. As a lawyer and a reporter, Marcia has covered the Supreme Court for 25 years and has earned numerous awards, including the George Polk Award for Legal Reporting. Marcia is also the author of the new book, The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. And Marcia, I want to welcome to The Exchange. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Dean. Thanks for having me.
Marcia, June is traditionally a busy month for the Supreme Court. We've already had these decisions on DNA collection and on voter registration requirements. What's your sense of how these two decisions fit into the Roberts Court, and what should we be looking out for in the coming weeks?
Well, first of all, just so you can get a sense of what's left in the term, we have about 14 cases that have yet to be decided by the court. Well, actually, they've probably been decided, but the court hasn't issued the decisions yet. There's possibly one more week left in the term. That's next week. This week we have a decision day on Thursday. Next week we may have 2 days, maybe 3 days. It really depends on how fast the justices crank out the decisions and the Supreme Court's printing office can print them up and have them ready for release. So there are 14 left, and in that 14, as you've pointed out, are some of the toughest cases for the justices, the cases involving affirmative action, voting rights, and same-sex marriage. For the voting rights and affirmative action cases, the reason they're so tough, I believe, is not only that they raise difficult legal questions, but they also play into some very strong feelings among the justices about questions of race and how we use racial classifications in these two cases for a good purpose, in a sense. We want to, for example, have diverse universities so that our children are prepared to work in a very diverse society someday. And then in the voting rights case, there's always concern about access to the polls. Our right to vote is probably our most important right under the Constitution. So these are racial classifications that are for what we call benign purposes, and yet for the justices, many of them feel we're at a point in society where we should be getting beyond race, or we have gotten beyond race. And yet there are other justices who feel we haven't reached that point yet and still need to have something of a boost in education and in voting. So they really play to deep divides among the justices. It's not so much politics. It's really a view of society today and also the law and what the law allows.
Now, Marcia, in your book, you talk about an earlier 5-4 landmark decision on racial preferences in schools. Is there anything in that decision that you think gives us a little bit of a hint about how these two issues may be decided, or do you expect kind of a similar outcome as a result?
Well, it's hard to tell. You know, I really try not to predict what the court's going to do, but I do believe, as I said in my book, that those that the court's decision in the Louisville and Seattle high school and elementary school cases really did show where the divide was on the court. And there are five justices. Mostly, those are five justices in what we call the conservative wing of the court who are extremely skeptical of the use of racial classifications. Chief Justice John Roberts, in particular, has made comments about the use of race that I think show how strongly he feels about this. He said in one of the first cases that he dealt with as Chief Justice, it was actually a Texas redistricting case. He said it was a sordid business, this divvying us up by race. In that case, he did not join the majority, which found that Texas had discriminated against Latinos in drawing a congressional district. And then came the Seattle and Louisville school cases. And in those cases, he wrote that in order to stop discrimination on the basis of race, we have to stop discriminating on the basis of race. So he feels very strongly about the use of racial classifications. And I think that based on the oral arguments this term in the affirmative action case involving the University of Texas and the voting rights case involving Shelby County, Alabama, he was very skeptical of the government's defense of race. And in those two cases. So I think we may see him writing, I believe, the voting rights case, Justice Kennedy probably writing the affirmative action case. There are at least four justices who feel the Constitution is what they call colorblind. And I think that's going to play out in those two cases, with Justice Kennedy being the one who is not sure we've reached that point. He said in the Louisville and Seattle school cases that he felt the colorblind constitution was aspirational, still aspirational. And that was back in 2007. So I'm not quite sure where he's going to be today. We'll just have to wait and see.
Now, we had the 7-2 decision yesterday that dealt with the voter registration requirements in Arizona. Arizona essentially requiring a different additional proof of citizenship in order to register to vote. 7-2 vote with Roberts and Scalia voting with a majority, and Alito and Thomas dissenting. This, in a way, has a racial component as well, correct? Because
yeah.
Of the sort of all the immigration issues in New Mexico. How do you see that decision matching up with what you've already expressed in terms of racial preferences?
Well, I think it, you're right. It does have that, but it was a very different type of case because it had to do with what we call federal preemption, whether the federal National Voter Registration Act trumped what Arizona was trying to do here. So the decision, and Justice Scalia wrote this decision, and he generally is among the block of justices who frown or dislike and vote against racial classifications. But here he was interpreting language in the federal law and what Arizona's law said to see if there was a conflict between the federal law and the Arizona law. And, you know, this was pretty much statutory interpretation, looking at what the federal law mandated and finding that the Arizona law conflicted with that. And when that happens, he said, under the Constitution's Elections Clause, that the federal law displaces or trumps Arizona's law. It was very interesting, though, to see the alignment of justices. You're right, you had Justice Scalia and the Chief Justice in the majority, and then you had stalwart conservatives in the dissent. But I didn't see this as a particularly racially tinged ruling. Justice Scalia was very skeptical in the oral arguments about Arizona's claim that its extra burden on proof of citizenship for voting registration did not conflict with the federal law. He thought the federal law's mandate that states accept and use the federal registration form was very clear. And so I wasn't surprised to see that he actually wrote the decision here.
So my sense is, though, that they weren't saying that states cannot do this under any circumstances. They have an opportunity, I think, to ask for permission from a federal commission and or a federal court, as some other states have done. Is that correct?
Absolutely. He left the door open. He even said Arizona could go back to the Federal Election Assistance Commission and ask to have the federal form include the state-specific requirement that people who register to vote in Arizona provide documentary evidence of citizenship. And he said that, well, you know, if the commission says no, that we're not going to do it, then Arizona, like other states, may challenge that decision in federal court. The Elections Commission actually has approved state-specific requirements in the past. Arizona applied for that specific citizenship evidence back in 2005, and the commission split 2-2 in voting on whether it would accept Arizona's state-specific requirement, and that was conceived as a rejection. But Arizona never appealed that, and Scalia also, during the oral arguments, found it, you know, very peculiar that Arizona didn't appeal the commission's decision. And when he pressed the Arizona Attorney General on, gee, why didn't you challenge that decision, the Arizona Attorney General could only say to him, well, that predated, you know, me coming into office.
Right. Marcia, we have to take a brief break. We'll continue with lots more on the Roberts Court, and we'll start taking your calls as well. So please stay with us.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Turning mostly cloudy today with more showers and thunderstorms. Highs 70 to 75 degrees. NHPR Daily Weather Report made possible with support from Public Service of New Hampshire. More on the Roberts Courts on the Exchange and a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, how the FBI and police are using facial recognition systems. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the McLean Law Firm and its intellectual property group, working on all aspects of IP protection, patent, trademark, copyright, and e-commerce online at mclane.com. From Granite State College Office of Graduate Studies, offering flexible schedules, faculty of expert practitioners, and curriculum focused on individual student goals, granite.edu/NHPR. And the Mood Disorder Service at Dartmouth, advancing research and treatment, resistant depression, on the web at mood.dartmouth.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're discussing the Supreme Court's workings under Chief Justice John Roberts. What are your impressions of the Roberts Court? Which decisions or issues before the court are of greatest interest to you? Do you think the Supreme Court has become too politicized in recent years? How can the court best preserve its legitimacy as a chief interpreter of our Constitution? We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Or send us a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Our guest this morning is Marcia Coyle, Chief Washington Correspondent for the National Law Journal and author of the book, The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. And Marcia, we've talked a little bit about these current decisions and what's coming up over the next 2 weeks with these 14 cases that are still outstanding. Let's take a step back now and talk about the concept of a Chief Justice. You know, we often identify the Supreme Court by their Chief Justices. We may talk about the Warren Court or the Rehnquist Court, and now we're talking about the Roberts Court. Can justices really leave a personal mark on the court, or is this just a historical shorthand that we typically use?
Well, I think they can leave a personal mark on the court. Certainly, Earl Warren did in his ability to get the court to be unanimous in the Brown versus Board of Education case, which desegregated our public schools. I think that may be the most important way. If there's a case that is of national concern, national interest, and also involves the institution's credibility with people, the voters, the Chief Justice, I think, strives to get as much unanimity and consensus on the court as possible. If you have a court that's always divided narrowly, say with 5-4 decisions, then the court's going to look, I would think the court would look to people as being political more often than not. From what I've seen of John Roberts, he does try very hard to achieve consensus. Something I point out in my book is that we in the media tend to focus on the high-profile cases, which often are the most divisive cases on the court, and they also tend to be constitutional cases, and yet that they're not really the meat and potatoes of the court's work. The court does a lot of statutory interpretation, and believe it or not, in more than 50% of the court's decisions each term, the justices are either unanimous or are producing decisions that are 8-1 or 7-2. So in this court, there's quite a bit of consensus across the board. It's in a narrow range. Let's say out of 75 to 80 decisions each term, you may have 15 to 20 that really cause them to split 5-4. So I think the Chief Justice can make his or her mark on the court in the ability to really achieve consensus in the more difficult cases, or to do it to find common ground so that when they do divide, they don't look like they're dividing politically. And that's a real tough job, Dean, right now on the Supreme Court, because the justices are split. Their ideological composition of the court, each justice, his ideological inclinations or hers, matches the president who appointed them. So you have five justices on the court appointed by Republican presidents and four by Democratic presidents. So when they do split 5-4 in that way, it looks like it's political. But as I said with the race cases, it's not so much political as there really are some very deep philosophical divides on this court about how to interpret the Constitution and also how to interpret federal laws.
So, Marcia, given what you've said, is it fair to say that a Chief Justice's mark on the Supreme Court, that his legal legacy, how legal scholars and others who pay close attention interpret the legacy, may diverge somewhat from what the public legacy is given public perceptions about either these high-profile decisions or ideological polarization on the court? I mean, it seems like there may be a little bit of a balancing act there. How does the court deal with this issue of public perception and legitimacy, or do they just not care about it because they're appointed for life and they assume that, you know, legal scholars will interpret their legacy at some point in the future?
I think they care very much about it, and I interviewed a number of them for my book. They know only too well that their legitimacy in the eyes of the public is really that's the only thing they have in terms of having their decisions accepted and followed in this country. They're not like Congress, which has the power of the purse, and they're not like the executive branch, which can enforce the law. All they have is the public's respect for the decisions they issue. Some may care more about that than others. I remember one justice telling me that after you've been on the court for a certain amount of time, the institution moves you, he said, and it moves some more than others, in particular a Chief Justice. And I think that's very true. I think John Roberts cares very much about how the court is viewed and accepted by Americans. And I think we saw that play out in the health care ruling. I don't know what's in John Roberts' mind. I don't know why he voted the way he voted. But I think, and I think others also believe, that one, I accept the fact that he believed that the individual mandate to purchase insurance could be upheld under Congress's power to tax. I think if you read the decision, you can accept his arguments. They were grounded. They were logical. But I also think that he cared about how the court was going to be viewed when the decision came out. And he was able to find a path that removed the court from becoming a political issue in the presidential election. The Chief Justice is also considered first among equals. That's a phrase they often use. And that's because they have one vote, just as each justice does. And these nine justices right now are very independent-minded, they look very carefully to see where they can find consensus. And sometimes it is the Chief Justice who leads them to that point. I'll tell you a funny thing about Chief Justice William Rehnquist. We in the press would have lunch occasionally with him, and one reporter once complained that, and did it in a humorous way, can't you do something about the fact that these justices are writing so many separate opinions in a case, concurrences in part, concurrences in the judgment, and he just laughed and said it would be like herding cats. They truly are independent-minded, but I think the Chief Justice in particular does search for some consensus where it can be found.
Right. And I want to talk a little bit more about the healthcare decision in a moment. But first, we're talking about the Roberts Court today on The Exchange. And you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org. Marcia, before we go to the phones, let me ask you one more question about the fallout from the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, it caught a lot of conservatives off guard. Some conservatives have said, well, this was a genuinely conservative decision by Roberts in the sense that he didn't want to overturn a legislative action, if at all possible, unless absolutely necessary. But others have said that he is another Justice David Souter. He was our former Chief Justice here in New Hampshire, appointed by George H.W. Bush. I believe that's correct. But Souter turned out to be a little bit more moderate and a little bit more unpredictable. And I've heard some conservatives who were quite angry with Roberts and felt like he was a traitor. So what's your sense of this? When we talk about him as being a conservative, there clearly are some differences with some of the other conservatives on the court.
Yes, there are. I mean, it is not a monolithic block by any means. In fact, Justice Scalia is not the same kind of conservative as, say, Justice Alito in all cases. You're right that he was, the Chief Justice was accused by some conservatives of betrayal in the health care decision. The word conservative can be an awfully loaded word. I think John Roberts is a conservative justice politically and in terms of a judge who respects precedent, tries to defer to Congress when possible in upholding federal laws. I don't by any means think that he's going to become a David Souter. And if you look at his history, where he worked, the kinds of positions he took when he was in the Solicitor General's office and in the White House under Ronald Reagan, he really is conservative in his ideology. So I think the way he acted in the healthcare case was as a true conservative judge, in the sense that there's this doctrine on the court that if you're looking at the constitutionality of a duly enacted law by Congress, and one way to interpret it would find it unconstitutional, but there is a way to look at the law that would uphold it as constitutional. A true conservative judge will avoid the conflict with the Constitution and with Congress and will take the constitutional path. And that's what he did in the health care law. So I think the criticism of him was unfounded. And I think we're going to see, you know, perhaps this term, where some of his true conservative stripes are ideologically when it comes to the race cases. So I say in my book, Dean, that this is a very young court in the sense that we had five new justices come on the bench in 5 years. And we really don't know yet how to identify the Roberts Court.
So in some sense,
or what his legacy will be.
Right. In some sense, it's a little premature to talk about his legacy, but it is. It does feel unusual to me, as someone who's watched the court for a while, to have this large, you know, sort of fairly large number of new justices in a short number of years. We were speaking about Justice Souter, and we have an email here. Tom from Rye sent us an email saying, could you comment on why Justice Souter really left the Supreme Court and what he's up to today? I mean, I know personally from New Hampshire, he's been involved in a number of civic engagement activities around the state, giving some public speeches. He's kind of retired to his library in a town right outside of our state capital, Concord. But do you have any sense of why he really left?
Yes, I think he made it very clear, and I do believe this, that he and other justices have told me this as well, that he missed New Hampshire. That is where his heart was. He said when he was in D.C., he had the best job in the world in the worst city. So he never really liked living in Washington, D.C. And I think, you know, he did his time, so to speak, on the court, and he wanted to go home to New Hampshire. And besides being involved in trying to renew interest in civics, he's also sitting as a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit.
Oh, that I did not know. That's interesting.
Yeah, he's not doing it full-time, but he's actually hearing cases and writing decisions. And he had said that he would, you know, remain active in that sense. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor also does that. She does that on the Ninth Circuit that covers the western part of the United States. So it's not unusual when justices retire to offer to help the federal appellate courts out, and he is doing that, and occasionally giving some wonderful speeches as well.
Great. Let's go to the phones now. We have Robert standing by in Bedford. Robert, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning.
Your question for Marcia.
Well, there's two comments, and I'd like to hear a response. The first is I really don't think that a lot of these decisions are fast-moving technological and scientific advances. We're not going to know what the real implications are for maybe 25 years, and that's involving a lot of it is the gene patenting is the first case, which I think was a miracle that the court came down to forbid that, because in the future that would cause quite a bit of problems for descendants of people who owns who physically. So I thought that was fascinating and wonderful across-the-board decision. But then again, we have the Monsanto case, which is related to gene patenting. Of course, that was artificial reproducing seed, but that will eventually infect, as we know, many crops. It'll spread, and so Monsanto will own most of our food industry as far as agriculture. And the second one was the DNA database collecting decision, which I think we're going to find in a long time is going to be nightmarish. And the only time in my life I've ever across the board, I mean, not my only time, one of the rare instances I could say Scalia is the only dissenting judge. Fascinating, and he's absolutely correct about what it means. But we will collect a data bank of anyone suspected
thanks,
of criminal
Robert,
activity.
Thanks, Robert.
This is very important because they have a data bank of that, and yet they fought the data bank on guns.
All right. Thank you, Robert. Let's hear what you have to say about that, Marcia.
Yeah, I have to tell you, Robert, you've really brought up some important points here. The court is increasingly being drawn into cases involving new technology. Some of the technology might not be so new to us, like the Fourth Amendment case they had involving police attaching a GPS unit to the underbelly of a suspect's car. I mean, we've had GPS for a long time. But the court hasn't faced those questions in terms of what the Constitution allows. And the DNA is another example of that. And even in the patent cases involving human genes and the wheat-resistant soybeans, these are really new technologies, and the court is trying to be very cautious, especially in the patent area, not to say too much is protected by patents in order to be sure that inventors get the information they need in order to continue to do research. But I think it is a very difficult issue for them. With the human gene decision, for example, there were a lot of patent lawyers who felt that the court got the science all wrong. And usually patent lawyers have science degrees as well. But the court is, it gets these cases and it has to work through them. And the only thing it can really do is try to be cautious. I was surprised that they found the DNA case so easy to decide, but they did, and they seem to struggle more with the GPS case. So it's really fascinating to watch now how they deal with these technological issues.
Yeah, Marcia, I would assume that whatever decade we choose, technology of some sort is an issue, whether it's the 70s or 80s or today. From your 25 years covering the court, what's your general sense of how the Supreme Court deals with these sorts of fast-moving technologies in terms of their decision-making? Do they tend to be fairly conservative, or do we get some real surprises based on whatever the technology is of the moment?
I think they try to be cautious, that they try not to write sweeping decisions. That's my sense of it. You may have felt, for example, that the DNA case was not that way at all. And as I said, I was kind of surprised that they found it rather easy to decide. But I think overall they try to be cautious in the gene patenting case, for example. At the end of that decision, Justice Thomas said exactly what the decision did not cover. And so I think that was a way of showing that, and he even said, the court is not addressing these issues at this time. We'll take them up when they get to us.
Marcia, we have to take one more break, but we'll come back. We have lots more to talk about on the Roberts Court with Marcia Coyle, and we'll take more of your calls and emails as well. So please stay with us.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and the NEEF Network organizations, a statewide leader assisting students and parents planning for college. Information at nhheaf.org. And from the White Mountains, where you can discover the natural beauty of New Hampshire and family fun at 16 themed attractions. Information at whitemountainsattractions.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
On the next Word of Mouth, catching up to technology. We'll explore how our culture is adapting to innovations and situations that until recently existed only in science fiction. From holograms preserving stories to new frontiers in litigation and space law. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth sends a postcard from the future on the next Word of Mouth. Today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the small state advantage in the United States Senate and Electoral College. Some say it's long past time to change the equation. Email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today we're looking at the Roberts Court. Since the confirmation of Chief Justice John Roberts, the court has taken on many controversial issues, from health care reform to gay marriage. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. We're talking with Marcia Coyle, Chief Washington Correspondent of the National Law Journal. She's a lawyer and a reporter and author of the new book, The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. And Marcia, I have an email here from Charles from Walpole, and this is an interesting topic that I often hear about when I talk about the Supreme Court. Justice Thomas. People are always fascinated to talk about Justice Thomas, in particular his relationship with Justice Scalia. Now, I sat in on oral argument a number of years ago, and it's a fascinating thing I recommend anyone do it if they have an opportunity. It's quite remarkable to watch. And it was one of the rare occasions where Justice Thomas actually spoke. He's not typically known for asking questions during oral argument. In fact, when he leaned forward to speak, I could see the law clerks running in the wings of the Supreme Court to come and hear what he had to say. So Charles writes and asks, basically what Charles wants to know is Justice Thomas so similar to Justice Scalia, or are there differences? Kind of what is Justice Thomas's identity as a Supreme Court justice?
Well, there is a high rate of agreement between the two when it comes to deciding cases, but there are significant differences between them. Justice Thomas is what we call an originalist in terms of interpreting the Constitution, as is Justice Scalia. But Justice Thomas follows that to the bitter end, so to speak. He will go wherever it takes him, even if it is a truly unpopular decision. He also has shown a willingness, and he stated this usually in his dissents, to re-examine whole swaths of constitutional doctrines. For example, he feels that the court's decisions on separation of church and state are wrong, and he would re-examine them and allow much greater accommodation of religion by government. You saw just yesterday in the Arizona elections decision how the two justices split. They also split on certain parts of the First Amendment in the campaign finance area, for example. In Citizens United, even though Thomas joined the majority in knocking down the ban on independent corporate expenditures in federal elections, the court upheld the requirements in federal law that there be disclosure of those of that spending. But Justice Thomas was the only one who dissented. He disagreed. He felt that even the disclosure requirements violated the First Amendment. So there are significant differences. Dina, I don't know when you heard him ask a question. It must have been a long time ago, because he really hasn't asked a question during oral arguments in, I think it's now 7 years.
It was, I can tell you, it was 1998.
Okay.
And well, I saw him again in 2000, and he didn't say anything.
Right. And that, to me, is very puzzling. He will tell you that he doesn't ask questions because he thinks there are too many questions being asked by justices, and the lawyers don't get a chance to make their arguments, which he says he wants to be able to hear. But it's really strange. In the early part of the court's history, and even through the 90s, not many questions were asked by justices, but I don't think any justice went 7 years without asking a question. This is a really hot bench. There are a lot of questions asked. They come fast and furious. But to me, it is passing strange that he doesn't ask questions.
I should mention for our listeners who have never sat in an oral argument or listened to a recording, basically the lawyers start talking and then the justices just start pelting them with questions immediately, almost essentially disregarding what they're saying. And then, you know, when there are no questions, they go back to giving their initial presentation. It really was quite remarkable to see. I also want to talk about another one of my favorite Supreme Court topics, judicial activism. For many years, conservatives argued that liberal justices legislate from the bench, that they essentially make policy and create rights where none exist in lieu of Congress doing the same. But more recently now, we've heard liberals say that conservative justices do this as well, that they are essentially activists in interpreting the Constitution to either limit or deny individual rights. Where do you come down on this whole issue of judicial activism? You know, do you think it's politically overblown, or is it a real concern in terms of the balance of powers?
Well, I think it's another one of those very loaded terms, and I try not to use it. I think you just have to look at the individual decisions and make your own decision about whether you think what they did here went beyond what their duties are as justices. There are areas where I think they have been activists. I know in the civil rights area, and I'm talking mainly about the interpretation of our federal job discrimination laws, that the court has at times, I'm thinking in particular of one case, and it was a Thomas opinion, in which the court ruled in a case on an issue that had not even been raised by either party and ruled in a way that increased the burden on people trying to prove age discrimination on the job. To me, that's a form of activism. In Citizens United, when the court ordered re-argument in that case and wrote the questions that it wanted the lawyers to argue and went beyond what the case itself had presented to the court, to me, that's also a form of activism. You know, conservative judges are known for respecting precedents, for deferring to Congress. As, you know, if, of course, if something's unconstitutional, they're not going to do that. But when there is a balance between the two, they should defer to those who are accountable to the people. So I think you have to look at individual cases.
I mean, it seems that it's been used so frequently now that it's essentially lost. I think it's almost lost its meaning. Is that fair to say?
Yes, absolutely.
You may have seen there was a piece in the New York Times in the last day or so talking about the Roberts Court and the kind of craftsmanship of the decisions. And the argument was essentially that that these decisions are long and opaque, that essentially the court is not doing a good job of giving guidance to lower courts when they make decisions. Is that a fair criticism?
Boy, that's a tough one, Dean. Again, I think it probably depends on the individual decision. When they write a narrow decision, it may not offer as much guidance as the lower courts want. And yet, they may be reluctant to issue a broader sweeping decision. So I think it really depends on what they're doing. I have to say that, you know, some of these decisions are very hard to read. They can be very technical. And yet, I think they do strive to provide some guidance. If they're divided, excuse me, I've got a frog in my voice.
Sure.
If they're divided, that can create problems for the lower court as well. So I think you have to look at the individual decision.
Sure. I want to go back and talk a little bit about to give our listeners kind of a feel for the court. You know, you've been there for 25 years. You mentioned that in the last 8 years, we have four new justices, including Roberts himself, who was elevated directly from the Court of Appeals to Chief Justice. Has the appointment of Roberts and Alito and Sotomayor and Kagan, the much younger court that you mentioned, has this had any visible impact on kind of the culture or functioning of the court? You know, in the sense of just kind of the demeanor of the justices, kind of the feel of how the court season runs, in your mind?
Yes, I think it has. First of all, it certainly has invigorated the bench in terms of questioning. Justices Sotomayor and Kagan are very active questioners. Not so much Justice Alito, but certainly Sotomayor and Kagan. I'm also told that they're more social, mm-hmm. Behind the scenes. Justice Sotomayor turned one of her offices into a kitchen, and she will cook or bake for the others. So I think that has had an impact as well. It just seems as though the court in general is more invigorated.
Yeah, that's great. You know, there have been periods in our history where the kind of the median age seems to be somewhere in the 80s, low 80s or high 70s. So it does seem to have a younger feel to it. I want to circle back to your book, The Roberts Court, a little bit. You know, your book focuses on these four landmark 5-4 decisions from the Roberts Courts. And I have two questions for you. One is about, the first is about Justice Kennedy. I have heard people say that essentially now oral argument is designed to try to swing Justice Kennedy to the right or to the left, that you essentially have four on each side and Kennedy in the middle. So I want your sense of whether or not that's an oversimplification. And then the other thing is, you know, you talk about these four, your book looks at the Roberts Court through these four decisions on racial preferences, campaign finance, gun rights, and health care. Which one of those do you think is most instructive for understanding the Roberts Court? But let's start with Justice Kennedy first.
Okay. Well, Justice Kennedy is considered the swing vote, although I'm told he hates being called that. But it's really only in, you know, these sort of narrow band of cases where the justices divide ideologically. He assumed that role after Justice O'Connor left. She was considered the center of the court. But the truth is, Justice Kennedy is more conservative on more issues than Justice O'Connor was. So he swings to the left less often than she did. But he is a pivotal figure in that narrow band of cases that involve race, religion, First Amendment, sometimes the death penalty. So, lawyers may try to gear their arguments towards him, but many lawyers will also tell you that it's foolish to, you know, really just rely on, one justice that you never quite know. In those difficult issues, you know, who's going to vote which way, and we saw that with the healthcare case.
When you're listening to oral argument, can you get a sense right off the bat? Oh, the lawyers are trying to work Justice Kennedy, or in this instance, they're not, or it's just too complicated typically to be able to tell.
Yeah, I don't hear it in the oral arguments, but I do see it in the briefs.
The briefs.
I saw it in the healthcare case where certain briefs really laid out certain arguments and quoted from Kennedy opinions in which it would seem pretty clear they were playing for his vote, but not so much in oral arguments.
On your book, now we have these four really pivotal decisions. You know, I'm a political scientist. I'm very familiar with the impact of the campaign finance reform. But in your mind, which one of these four is sort of the big ticket item to understanding the Roberts Court, or is it perhaps more than one?
Well, that's a great question. I think the healthcare case was very instructive. Because one, it showed how the Chief Justice was willing to break with the conservative wing in upholding the mandate, and also how two justices on the so-called liberal wing of the court were willing to join the conservatives on the expansion of Medicaid. So reading their reasoning for doing that was just fascinating. Justice Ginsburg disagreed with Roberts and the conservatives on the Commerce Clause and wrote this really amazing opinion tracing the history of the Commerce Clause. And so that was very instructive, as was the fact that four conservatives on the court were willing to take down the entire law because of the mandate. And there was so much in that law that had nothing to do with the mandate. So reading their opinion was very instructive. So I think healthcare really is the one.
The campaign finance reform, let's talk about that briefly. This is one of those perennial issues that comes through the courts on occasion. Is your sense of the court that there will be any opportunity to limit the impact of money, or does it seem pretty firm that money is a version of speech in the eyes of this court?
I don't see any indication that the five who voted in Citizens United are willing to backtrack on how they view money in elections. In fact, last term, if you recall, we had the case out of Montana in which the Montana Supreme Court upheld its ban on corporate spending. When it was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, five justices just slapped it down immediately, very briefly, saying Citizens United applies, boom, you're gone. So I don't see any evidence that they want to backtrack. They really believe that what they said was right. Next term, we have another big campaign finance case. Well, who knows how that's going to come out, but I'd be very surprised if they decided in any way to erode what they said in Citizens United. This court is a very strong First Amendment court, First Amendment speech court.
Marcia, we only have about a minute left. I wanted to real quick to get your overall sense of what are you looking forward to seeing most in the next week or two? What's the one that you, the decision of those that you mentioned that you think is going to be the one that really gets the attention?
I think same-sex marriage, without question. And there are two cases that they have to decide on that issue. And I think that will really show us, you know, what kind of court this is. Adding affirmative action and voting rights, we're going to learn an awful lot about the Roberts Court probably by the end of next week. But I think same-sex marriage is the one to focus on, who writes it and what they say, how broad it is.
Well, Marcia, we are out of time. I think we're all going to be watching Chief Justice of the Supreme Court very closely over the next couple weeks as we await these rulings. I'd like to thank my guest, Marcia Coyle, for joining us this morning. Marcia is Chief Washington Correspondent for the National Law Journal, and she's author of the new book, The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. Marcia, thank you for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure, Dean. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our intern is Faith Mikesill. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, in for Laura Kanoy.